Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Stephen Buehler, Aaron Douglas Professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches courses on Shakespeare and other writers of the English Renaissance. He is the author of Shakespeare in the Cinema, Ocular Proof, and co-founder and education director of the Flatwater Shakespeare Company based in Lincoln. Dr. Buehler will speak on the topic Shakespeare's First Folio and the First Folio's Shakespeare. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 19, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Christy Jensen, Executive Director of the Durham Museum.
Stephen M. Buehler is the Aaron Douglas Professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches courses on Shakespeare and other writers of the English Renaissance. Previously Director of the Medieval and Renaissance Studies Program at UNL and Research Fellow at the Huntington and Folger Shakespeare Libraries, he is also co-founder and Education Director of the Flatwater Shakespeare Company, based in Lincoln, Nebraska. Dr. Buehler will also be participating next week in the museum's Scholars in Residence program, which connects local and national scholars to area classrooms to explore topics that include arts, culture, science, and industry. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Buehler.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you all so much for being here. It's just a pleasure to share such wonderful stuff about wonderful stuff. So let me get started here. If you were wandering into a bookstore in 1623 or 1624, wondering about making a major investment, and you turned a few pages of the unbound, as yet unbound volume, you would see the name of William Shakespeare, you would see an engraved image of Shakespeare, and then you would also see a poem about that portrait. And this portrait and its poem begins the process by which the First Folio makes Shakespeare, perhaps not as much as Shakespeare makes the First Folio, but it certainly has a hand in shaping how we think of Shakespeare, what we know about Shakespeare, and how we appreciate Shakespeare. And it starts with this poem. To the reader, this figure that thou here seest put, it was for gentle Shakespeare cut, wherein the graver, that is the engraver, had a strife with nature to outdo the life, and the implication is, did not do a great job of capturing the life, but nevertheless, oh, could he but have drawn his wit as well in brass as he hath hit his face, the print would then surpass all that was ever writ in brass. But since he cannot, reader, look not on his picture, but his book. And this is not the First Folio that's making the tour. This is one of a series of facsimiles. This is mid-20th century. But the mere fact that so many facsimiles have been made over the last few centuries, again, gives us an idea of the profound impact of this volume and what this volume delivers. If you look at the table of contents, you'll see something rather distinctive about the organization. It begins the process of organizing Shakespeare's plays by more or less their genres. So you have the comedies, the histories, the tragedies, and you might also notice that the pagination begins over as you shift from genre to genre. The organizers of the project and the printers and the booksellers were not certain if this was going to fly. This was going to be a major investment. Roughly 20 shillings a pound, we approximated, was sold for. So in case sales flagged, you could choose which genre you liked best and pay just 7 or 8 shillings and then think about buying the rest. What's extraordinary is that it succeeded as a complete volume from the very, very beginning. The table of contents does not include the play Troilus and Cressida. That's because Troilus and Cressida had been published in an individual edition earlier on, what's called a quarto version. What's the difference between a quarto and a folio? With a folio, big sheet of paper, fold it once, folio. Fold it again into quarters, quarto. Now, already we're getting a sense as to the different impact of however valuable, however interesting, however exciting individual plays might be, the difference between a collection of separate quarto volumes and a book like this is something that helped to shape the impact of Shakespeare in the subsequent centuries. To really show my age, I might quote the great sociological observer Crocodile Dundee. That's not a knife. That's a knife. That's not a book. That's a... And so you get the idea of how there's a kind of authority and also a kind of monitoring of reader interest that people are willing to make this kind of investment. What we also notice is that lots of plays that never made it to quarto version, we only have because members of Shakespeare's theater company, at first the Lord Chamberlain's men, then the King's men, decided that they would share their own in-house copies in order to make the work known. Those that had been published previously, though, they had to negotiate not with Shakespeare, who had died 7 years ago, and besides didn't really have the rights to the plays, they had to negotiate with the printers and booksellers that had put them on the market. They weren't sure that they would get Troilus and Cressida, but a little bit into the actual press run of the tragedies, we've got it, we can include it, and so just before Coriolanus, they start with page one, two, three, and then they realized, oh, heck, we're not going to repage everything else subsequently, so they just sort of give up. So most copies of the folio have Troilus and Cressida just kind of tipped in at the beginning of the tragedies. But look at what we wouldn't have. Think of the kinds of characters, stories, phrases that we might not have without the folio. The Tempest. We are such stuff as dreams are made on. And leave not a rack behind. Well, that would have applied to The Tempest itself. The histories, you'll note, well, we don't particularly care about those histories all that much ourselves. But Henry VIII is a magnificent play. The Victorians loved it because there were three incredible roles: Henry himself, Cardinal Wolsey, and intriguingly enough, Catherine of Aragon. And the Victorian audiences just loved these star turns in those particular roles. But we get to the tragedies. Not have Julius Caesar, not have friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. That would be a loss indeed. So what would have survived without the folio? Let's do a little thought experiment in terms of what might Shakespeare look like or mean to us if we just had the individually produced plays. So we'd have The Merry Wives of Windsor, Much Ado About Nothing, Love's Labour's Lost, A Midsummer Night's Dream, The Merchant of Venice. Many of the best-known comedies we'd still have. We'd have all the heavyweight histories. Richard II, the first and second parts of Henry IV, Henry V, the second and third parts of Henry VI, Richard III. And that might have had an influence on what we think of Shakespeare as a dramatist if that particular part of his canon was already enshrined just through quarto publication. The tragedies. Titus Andronicus, although it was only one quarto copy was kind of found, so that's rather intriguing. Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet had a couple of editions in quarto. King Lear had a couple of editions in quarto, and Othello, and also possibly Pericles, although, again, it depends on whether that was found. But even if we had these plays in quarto versions, we would not have had necessarily the plays that we have come to know and love thanks to the folio versions. For example, this is the title page from the 1608 quarto edition of The History of King Lear. Not classified as a tragedy, but as a true chronicle history. And there's a spoiler alert right there on the title page. It's of the life and death of King Lear and his three daughters. Subplot information is provided. It's all about Edgar, the Duke's son, disguising himself as a mad beggar. There are the announcements about royal associations. Shakespeare's company by that time was known as the King's Men after the accession of King James of Scotland to the English throne, after a long career as the Lord Chamberlain's Men. And the play was performed at one of the king's palaces on the Feast of Stephen on December 26th. But along with those royal associations, there's business as usual. But you know, His Majesty's servants can be seen playing usually at the Globe on the bankside of the Thames River, so come on down, is part of the messages there. Along with that message, if you look at the right side, that's the way the play ends in the quarto version. One of the things that you notice is that Shakespeare's blank verse disappears. All the words get mushed together because the printer miscalculated and therefore wasn't going to just tack on a few extra pages in order to have the nice, elegant blank verse line, so smushed it all together to fit it in that way. But that's not the most interesting thing about this passage. In the quarto version, which may well reflect how the play was originally staged, we get to the heartbreaking lines that Lear utters after he is carried onto the stage, the body of his daughter Cordelia. And he says, "And my poor fool is hanged? No, no life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat of life, and thou no breath at all? Oh, thou would come no more, never, never, never. Pray you, undo this button," he says to somebody else on stage. "Thank you, sir." And then, startlingly, Shakespeare simply writes for his great actor, "Oh, oh, oh, oh." Is this another howl? Lear comes on the stage carrying Cordelia, asking everybody else to howl, howl, in grief and agony at the death of Cordelia? Or is this finally giving voice to the nothing that haunts the play in the language of the characters? Edgar says, he faints, "My lord, my lord," and Lear says, "Break, heart, I prithee, break." In the quarto version, Lear wills himself to die. He chooses not to take it anymore. Now, this is a startling stage effect that perhaps Shakespeare backed off from in King Lear, but he returns to in Antony and Cleopatra, where there is a character, Enobarbus, Antony's trusted advisor, who decides Antony's going to lose, I'm going to jump sides to Octavius Caesar, and immediately regrets it, to the extent that, as he says earlier in the play, he will simply think and die. And then the play continues the way we usually think of it in the folio, with one interesting change from what we're familiar with. In the quarto version, because it's a history play, you want some sense of an orderly transition of power, and it is the Duke of Albany that says the last lines. And then on the left is the more familiar folio version. And it is Kent who says, "Break heart, I prithee break." And those final howls are not given to Lear. And the final lines are given to Edgar, the next generation. So when we see a production or read an edition, we have to go with what the director and the dramaturg and the advisor in a performance, or what the editor does in an edition, in trying to figure out what is the best or truest rendering of what Shakespeare was about. Well, we don't know what Shakespeare is about, but in fact, we're just given this other great opportunity of picking and choosing and weighing and either conflating or going with one version or the other. This is another gift that the folio grants. So if we didn't have the folio plays, if we just had the individual plays, what would Shakespeare be best known for? Well, as I mentioned before, all of his English history plays are very well represented in quarto, and it might be that Shakespeare would be best known as a dramatist of British history to the extent that it might affect the United States embracing Shakespeare as a national poet. If Shakespeare is so strongly identified with questions of royalty and actual English history, could a nation trying to distinguish itself from its colonial ancestor really feel comfortable with that? Now, this was a debate that actually did go on throughout the 19th century. For a long time, people really thought that maybe somebody like John Milton, revolutionary, would be a much better pick as a kind of poetic spokesperson from the past for this new nation. Somebody like Walt Whitman was deeply skeptical that a royalist like Shakespeare, maybe not reading Shakespeare all that carefully, but nevertheless, he had lots of company, would really be able to speak for this young nation. So we would have most of the Henry VI plays and Richard III, and if we include the first part, which the folio gives us, those first four plays, known as the first tetralogy, was kind of Shakespeare's breakthrough. They were very, very popular in his time. That's one of the reasons why they inspired quarto editions. And they were so successful that a few years later, Shakespeare and his career decided to write a second tetralogy set earlier. So that's why we start with Henry VI and then we back up to Henry IV in the second tetralogy, because he was interested in exploring what led up to the events that kind of established his career as a playwright. Even so, however great the achievement, however magnificent the roles, would the United States have really thought in terms of Shakespeare's our guy too? Clearly we do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be gathered here tonight. There wouldn't be a copy of the first folio just down the hall. But could that have happened without the folio itself? Would Shakespeare be primarily known for other individual works, such as his narrative poems, for his ability to revisit the Roman poet Ovid or the Roman historian Livy? He published Venus Adonis back in 1593, a very fanciful rewrite of a passage in Ovid's Metamorphoses. He followed that up with The Rape of Lucrece, talking about the legendary foundations of Rome and resistance against kingship. First published in 1594 and was regularly reprinted. This is a copy that was printed in 1602. And if you look at the disc imprint over by the right margin, that is the print from the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which initially did not collect plays, especially individual quarto plays. That's not serious literature. But something like this, an elegant reworking of classical materials dedicated to noblemen, that would be worthwhile. What helped to change the Bodleian's mind is something like the publication of the first folio and what made that publication possible. Of course, it's also possible that Shakespeare would also be primarily known as a sonneteer, and this is from the 1609 quarto edition of his sonnets. It says, never before imprinted, a little bit of false advertising there. A few of the sonnets did appear in anthologies previously, but it is true that this edition by T.T. Thomas Thorpe did bring together the 154 sonnets that we associate with Shakespeare. Even if they weren't in print, they were pretty widely known in manuscript. For example, in 1598, a writer by the name of Francis Mears wrote a kind of survey of the state of culture in England at the end of the 16th century called Palladist Tamia, and he talks about Shakespeare as a playwright, but he really stresses the sweet, witty soul of Ovid lives in the mellifluous and honey-tongued Shakespeare. Witness his Venus and Adonis, his Lucrece, his sugared sonnets among his private friends, etc. And it shows that Shakespeare himself alternated between kind of a theatrical identity and a more literary identity. Publishing these narrative poems dedicated to aristocrats and sonnets which propose a kind of maybe romance or at least infatuation on the part of a poet and a beautiful young nobleman, the fair young man, we're not sure that we want that just out where anybody can just pick it up and buy it and enjoy it. Let's keep it among the coterie. Let's keep it among the group of folks that know best how to read it. Keep them in manuscript. To the extent that we're not sure how involved Shakespeare was in the publication of his sonnets, even though this is still 7 years before his death. Or maybe he was involved but thought a little plausible deniability would keep him out of trouble. But if all we had from Shakespeare were these individual works, are we now looking at the alternative face of English literature? Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson, who wrote that poem to the reader opposite Shakespeare's image. The initials are B.I., but that's the affectation of writing J's the way they would in ancient Roman times and Latin. So B.I. is actually B.J., which is actually Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson was a rival playwright. Ben Jonson was also apparently a friend of Shakespeare's. And in 1616, the year of Shakespeare's death, Ben Jonson did an audacious thing. He collected his own works, gathered them together, called them works, and gave himself the full folio treatment. Ben had a very healthy ego, and knew it and admitted it too. Ben also hedged his bets. He didn't just print his plays. He is going to do his works, the opera, as in the Latin term for collected works. So, yeah, the plays are there, but mostly his poems, and especially the text that he composed for masks, royal entertainments. Even so, the relative success of Jonson's 1616 folio gave some of Shakespeare's partners an idea. If Ben could do this himself, to himself and for himself, maybe we could extend the folio treatment to our late colleague, William Shakespeare. This is from Jonson's folio works, and it is the text of one of his least successful plays. It had a very, very short run, which is a shame. It's an amazingly brutal look at the corrupting power of politics and the politics of corrupting power. One of the things that Johnson makes clear, though, is that he is indebted to a company for attempting it, for staging it, for paying him for it. And so Sejanus's fall, we are told, was first acted in the year 1603 by the King's Majesty's servants, with the allowance of the Master of Revels, by the author, B.J., and after listing the characters and setting the scene, Rome, listing the principal tragedians, the actors who performed in the tragedy. And if we go left to right, Richard Burbage, the greatest actor of Shakespeare's day and the leading actor of Shakespeare's company, William Shakespeare, right next to Burbage. Augustus Phillips, John Hemmings, remember that name or a version of it, William Sly, Henry Condell, remember that name, John Lowen, and Alexander Cook. And perhaps seeing their names and Shakespeare's names in print inspired some of these actors that we need to save, preserve, share Shakespeare's works too. Hence the experiment of the folio. And Johnson didn't just contribute a nice, clever little poem about you can't capture the wit in an image, you can only capture wit in words. He also contributed an incredible memorial poem, some of which I'd like to share with you. After a little hemming and hawing about you can trust me, I'm going to be honest in my praise of Shakespeare, he will start addressing Shakespeare directly. And this is how Ben Jonson, who had a pretty high opinion of his own worth as an artist, recognizing that there was somebody better. Soul of the age, he writes. The applause, delight, the wonder of our stage. My Shakespeare, rise. I will not lodge thee by Chaucer or Spenser or bid Beaumont lie a little further to make thee a room. And he's referring to the fact that Shakespeare is not in the Poet's Corner in Westminster Abbey. He's back home in Stratford-upon-Avon. And Johnson says, that's really okay because you were a man apart while you were living, and I guess you need to be one now. Thou art a monument without a tomb, and art alive still while thy book doth live, and we have wits to read and praise to give. And then Johnson begins to measure Shakespeare against contemporaries and the greats of the past. Thou, still addressing Shakespeare, didst our Lily outshine. Lily specialized in very, very mellifluous language himself, very extravagant, fantastical, and elegant comedies. Or sporting kid we know best now from the Spanish tragedy, one of the influences on Hamlet. Or Marlowe's mighty line. That is, Marlowe may have perfected blank verse, iambic pentameter, on the dramatic stage. It's his mighty line. He really established it. But you, Shakespeare, outdid him. So again, to invoke a not-quite-so-old movie, think of Shakespeare in Love. And think of everybody auditioning for the new play Romeo and Juliet. And everybody's audition piece is from Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. Was this the face that launched a thousand ships? The blank verse line. And then magically Gwyneth Paltrow shows up and recites some of Shakespeare's own dramatic poetry instead, setting the events in place. But you also have in that film that wonderful exchange with Rupert Everett playing Christopher Marlowe and Joseph Fiennes playing Shakespeare and, you know, talking about titles and just the kind of shop talk that must have indeed happened in a thriving artistic community. But Johnson says Shakespeare's not just great compared to his contemporaries. course, he has to add a little dig. And though thou hadst small Latin and less Greek. Now, Johnson was self-taught. Johnson was not a university wit either. Johnson was a bricklayer's son who lucked into some of the amazing primary and secondary education that was available in London, and he made himself one of the leading humanists, that is, scholars of classical material of his time. So if anybody could get away with it, those lines, Ben could. But he would say, even though you're not as steeped in those languages, from thence to honor thee, that is, from Latin and Greek, I would not seek for names. I wouldn't have to think, oh, could I match? Of course, Ben says, you match up with anybody. But call forth thundering Aeschylus, Euripides, and Sophocles, him of Cordova, that is Seneca, the great Roman tragic poet, him of Cordova dead to life again, to hear thy buskin tread and shake a stage. Buskin, the high platform shoes that tragic actors wore. Or when thy socks were on, in ancient times, when comedies were played, you wouldn't want to do any kind of slapstick and platform shoes, so you just wore socks so you could do more knockabout stuff. Or when thy socks were on, leave thee alone for the comparison of all that insolent Greece or haughty Rome sent forth, or since did from their ashes come. You are a better comic writer than Plautus, Terence. It's an astonishing claim. And all those other Romance language countries like Italy or France or Spain. And this becomes a point of national pride. And I think it is the beginning of Shakespeare being embraced as England's national poet. Triumph, my Britain, says Ben. Thou hast one to show to whom all scenes of Europe homage owe. And here it is. He was not of an age, but for all time. Now, Ben is mostly looking back, but Shakespeare certainly made good on Ben's claim moving forward as well. Shakespeare's appreciation grows. The volume that gives us so much of Shakespeare is revered. And people begin to keep even the first folios. There was a second folio with a bunch of plays that he didn't write, but they claimed it, and that had to be worked out. Pericles was finally found. There was a third folio and a fourth folio, and usually, oh, this is a new approved version. We don't need the old ones, but people hold on to them. In fact, we keep finding them. This is the beginning of the actual plays in a copy of the first folio found in the special collections room of a French public library. This is the famous Saint-Omer folio, which was found just in 2014. Where did that come from? How did they get that? There was, near Saint-Omer, an English Jesuit seminary. After the Protestant Reformation, you couldn't train for the Catholic priesthood in Britain, so you did it in France, and then you tried to infiltrate your way back into English society, which is why the name Neville there at the top was actually the kind of travel name of one of the Jesuit priests in training, who apparently got hold of a folio from his family and left it there. Or just this year, in a stately home on the Isle of Bute, Scotland, the Mount Stuart House, and it's called Mount Stuart because these are noble descendants of one of the illegitimate lines from an early Scottish king. They had somebody go through their library, and lo and behold, they've got a first folio too. This was just a couple months ago. The great scholar of the history of the book, Peter Blaney, estimates, and he's gone through archives and the paperwork and the ledgers of the print houses, Peter estimates that probably 750 folios were printed. We have around 233 still existing. That's an amazing survival rate for a 400-year-old volume. They are valuable. One of the figures shared by the Folger is that one copy of the folio at a 2001 auction went for $6.2 million, hence the security setup that we have for this copy. But what's interesting, as Peter Blaney points out, is that it's not valuable because it is rare. It's valuable because it's valued. People care about it. And so, particularly through the 18th and 19th centuries, collectors wanted to own a folio if they could. And also, if you couldn't own a folio, let's go get a facsimile instead. And oftentimes, those front pages disappeared through the years. People really loved the picture of Shakespeare. So facsimile companies really specialized in reproducing those early pages, and those are often pasted into folio copies. And a very well-to-do Standard Oil Company exec by the name of Henry Folger decides that he is going to, in effect, corner the market on Shakespeareana, including folios, as we've heard before. At this point, the Folger Shakespeare Library, which was created to not only house his collection, but share his collection with the scholarly community. They have 82 mostly complete copies themselves. So the Folger has plenty of copies to share and to put out on tour to the 50 states and also Puerto Rico and D.C., Folger not only collected folios, he collected prompt books from theatrical companies, he collected editions, archival materials, pioneering scholarship on Shakespeare, and there across from the Library of Congress is this beautiful building, the Folger Shakespeare Library, which has become, as it was initially conceived, a center for scholarship. It is also a wonderful center for education, teaching teachers how to teach Shakespeare to the youngest of children. And also, although it's been up and down over the years, but right now they're thriving, there is a nice kind of Jacobean-style theater at the far end of the building, and they do amazing productions there. So it's also a center for performance. This is the old reading room, now called the Gail Kern Pastor Reading Room, named in 2011 after a longtime director of the library. And it's modeled, as you can see, after a great hall of an Elizabethan house, only here this is a working library where scholars can go and consult reference works, have rare works brought to them. No, they usually don't have a folio just sitting out there. That's a facsimile there, too. And talk about the Church of Shakespeare. You see a stained glass window at the very end. And the stained glass window depicts the seven ages of man from Jaques' amazing speech in As You Like It. This was designed by Nicola D'Assenzo and executed by his studio in the 1920s. But this is the speech that gives us all the world's a stage, and you find these rather cleaned up versions of the stages of life that Jaques talks about. From the infant mewling and puking in the lover's arms, you have the lover sighing like furnace with an ode to his mistress' eyebrow. After the schoolboy creeping like snail unwillingly to the school, then the lover with his flute, the soldier who looks awfully noble, but Jaques has a rather skeptical view of somebody who seeks the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth, then the justice, then the lean and slippered pantaloon, and then second childishness. It's, however, an inspiring thing to look at if you're lucky enough to do research there, and you realize this window would not be possible without the first folio, because As You Like It did not appear in quarto. We only have Jaques and his speech and All the World's a Stage because of the folio. And because of that, we wouldn't have a character like Rosalind. Somebody was talking about playing Rosalind earlier, disguising herself as Ganymede, Viola in Twelfth Night disguising herself as Cesario. Imogen disguising herself as a boy, reflecting the fact that only males could appear on English stages. So it makes sense to have your boys playing girls, play girls pretending to be boys as quickly as possible. The folio also gives us the majority of the plays that establish Shakespeare as the dramatist of the Renaissance, meaning the dramatist of the classical past. After all, Renaissance means rebirth. What is being reborn? They hoped everything that was of value of Greece and Rome. So Coriolanus, Cymbeline, Julius Caesar, Timon of Athens, Antony and Cleopatra. There's a wonderful playbill for Edwin Booth as Hamlet, one of the later revivals of his legendary turn in that role. Before Edwin Booth started his 100 performance run as Hamlet, he did a benefit to raise money for the Shakespeare statue that you can still see in Central Park. And he decided, for this special event, let's get all the Booth boys together and let's do a play about an assassination. So, here we have Junius Brutus Booth Jr., their father was a noted actor, playing Cassius, Edwin Booth in the lead role as Brutus, and their brother, John Wilkes Booth, playing Mark Antony. And there you have John Wilkes as Antony, pretending to come to some sort of understanding with the conspirators afterwards. Edwin as Brutus, encouraging Cassius to accept the offer. Cassius knows better, and Cassius is right. But you also have this frightening realization that this is November 25th, 1864, and just a few months later, in another theater, on April 14th, 1865, John Wilkes Booth would shoot Abraham Lincoln. Jump down on the stage to deliver a line associated with Caesar's assassins. Sic semper tyrannis, thus it always is with tyrants. And you wonder, without the hold of Shakespeare on the American psyche already, and the hold of that particular play, which we only have thanks to the folio, to what extent did that contribute to John Wilkes Booth's impulse to try to be the next Brutus, even though he knows it does not turn out well for those conspirators either? And then there are the Macbeths, perhaps the original power couple. They're also, well, speaking of assassination, that word first appears in print in the English language in Macbeth. Assassin, borrowed from Arabic, had appeared previously, but not assassination. They're not just a power couple. They're an amazing story, too. Despite their destructive tendencies and self-destructive tendencies, they listen so powerfully to each other. After assassinating Duncan, Macbeth talks about, no, this hand will rather the multitudinous seas and carnadine, making the green one red. And you have to wonder if that echoes in Lady Macbeth's mind as later she sleepwalks and sees blood on her own hands. Without damned spot, out I say, here's the smell of blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. And that out, then, perhaps Macbeth has heard that in other occasions. And when he learns of his wife's death, out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and is heard no more. Or how about just book titles inspired by folio plays? We wouldn't have Brave New World that hath such people in it. This Rough Magic, I hear, cast off, both from The Tempest. The Sound and the Fury, Faulkner rewriting Macbeth. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. Or, of course, by the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. Or The Dogs of War, when Antony shares with the audience the trouble he hopes to stir up in the aftermath of Julius Caesar's death. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. Or another rewrite, The Fault in Our Stars, from Cassius's speech trying to persuade Brutus to join the conspiracy. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Or also something I really love, Gaudy Night, which is one of the last of Dorothy Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey mysteries, which is about Antony and Cleopatra before a fateful battle, wanting one more gaudy night. Before I finish, though, and I will, believe it or not, I want to talk about the people who made the folio possible. First and foremost, John Hemming and Henry Condell, two shareholders and fellow actors. And don't give anybody grief about Shakespeare's name never appearing spelled the same way twice. Even Jonson spells it two different ways in that poem. And Hemming or Hemmings, he keeps changing the spelling of his name too. They are involved in gathering together the materials and providing it to the printer, what hadn't appeared in folio. You also have to remember the acting company itself. Shakespeare had the benefit of a stable acting company for whom he could write roles. He had the luxury of not having to say, oh, I can only have one really, really great role, like a Marlowe play, because I'm not sure anybody else will have the chops for it. He knew his ensemble could carry it off, so he could have 2, 3, 4, 5 fascinating characters all interacting. And sometimes a change in personnel would change the way he wrote. The first comedic expert, the first clown in the company was William Kemp, where broader characters like Nick Bottom in The Taming and Midsummer Night's Dream or Lancelot Gobbo in The Merchant of Venice. But then Kemp goes off on his own, and he's replaced by Robert Armin, a very gifted musician. And all of a sudden, you've got singing fools throughout thing, like Feste in Twelfth Night, the melancholy kind of touchstone in As You Like It, and of course, Lear's own fool. And in the folio, Hemmings and Condell make certain to give credit to the remainder of the company. We also need to keep in mind that Shakespeare did not write all of these plays by himself. Not only did he borrow from existing material, he worked with other writers, especially the younger writer John Fletcher, with whom he wrote Two Noble Kinsmen. Also, the lost play Cardenio, apparently inspired by Cervantes' Don Quixote. And we have to keep in mind that we are going to honor the death, 400th anniversary of the death of Cervantes, too. He also died April 23rd, 1616, just a different April 23rd, 1616, because Spain, Catholic, adopted the Gregorian calendar. England, Protestant, said no for, I think, another century more, or over a century and a half more. So it's the same date, just not the same day. Or Thomas Middleton, who apparently was brought in as a script doctor, and what we have of both Macbeth and Measure for Measure are rewrites, but Timon of Athens was a collaboration with Shakespeare. Or, as the great Oxford scholar Emma Smith, who has two fine books on the folio out this year, one isn't yet out on the States, but it's coming, reminds everybody, authors produce many things. What they don't produce is books, meaning they don't come ready in this fashion once an author is done. We have to keep in mind the printers and the booksellers, William Jaggard and Edmund Blount, the typesetters, the proofreaders, the inkmen, the pressmen, the sellers, the binders. We also have to thank the collectors, because one of the reasons we have over 200 copies of the folio is that people have put together pieces from what were separate folios, and these fragments have been combined in order to get the full pagination. And of course, collaboration and community. is found in the National Endowment for the Humanities in the Folger Shakespeare Library, sharing copies of the folio across this nation. And the day that this exhibit opened, my dear friend, the brilliant playwright and actress Becky Boson, posted this on Facebook. "So like a nerd of decent quality, I hit the road after rehearsal to see the first folio at the Durham. What makes it so special is that so many of Shakespeare's greatest known works would have been lost without the dedication of his closest friends who believed in him. I'm no Shakespeare, but Will and I have that one thing in common. Here's to believing in one another." Becky is right, but Will has something to do with it too. His singular talent, his singular talents, making sure that what he had left us, as Johnson's title of the memorial poem says, was well worth saving and keeping. And this is how Johnson's poem of tribute ends. "Look how the father's face lives in his issue. Even so, the race of Shakespeare's mind and manners brightly shines in his well-turned and true-filed lines, in each of which he seems to shake a lance as brandished at the eyes of ignorance. Sweet swan of Avon, what a sight it were to see thee in our waters yet appear and make those flights upon the banks of Thames that so did take Eliza, Queen Elizabeth, and our James, King James. But stay, I see thee in the hemisphere advanced and made a constellation there." And Johnson echoes the classical poets that would see characters transformed to gods or constellations in the sky, as in Ovid's Metamorphoses, and sees Shakespeare in the sky and says, "Shine forth, thou star of poets, and with rage or influence chide or cheer the drooping stage, which, since thy flight from hence, hath mourned like night and despair's day, but for thy volumes, light." I encourage you to go on YouTube, find Sir Ian McKellen about migrants or immigrants. Shakespeare was called in as a script doctor for a play about Sir Thomas More. Things were beginning to change, particularly during James's reign, and things were not quite as anti-Catholic, especially as you got further away from that whole gunpowder plot thing. And so maybe the time is right to revisit the events of Thomas More, since we already got away with doing a play about Henry VIII. And this is based on a historical incident where London craftsmen and guildsmen were up in arms because all of these immigrants from Amsterdam were coming in and taking our jobs, and Moore comes in and delivers this brilliant speech about, what if you were the migrant? What if you, for whatever reason, had to come to a foreign shore? What would you feel? And then, even if you don't put yourself in that position, what are you doing to the foundations, the fabric of our society, if you single out the sojourner in this way? It's a brilliant speech, and it shows Shakespeare still, at least in short bursts, at the height of his powers, and it shows the esteem that he was held in by his fellow company men, where, okay, we need a speech about this that people will buy as effective at turning, you know, in effect, calming a riot. Who can, I know who could write a speech that people would buy. Will, come on down from Stratford, help us out here. And he does, and that seems to be the one passage that we have in his own hand. And it still works very powerfully. Of course, Sir Ian can make things very powerful too, but I encourage you to track it down and read that up too. So we do have, apparently, that snippet of autograph Shakespeare writing blank verse lines. We have all this testimony about what an amazing figure that he was in letters and on stage. And so for the perennial question, did Shakespeare write Shakespeare? For me, somebody who made a very good living with the stage and on the stage is probably our number one candidate as author for a body of work that continues to enchant, enthrall, and instruct audiences to this day, and I would say for the foreseeable future.
Someone says that the strangers should be removed, and Thomas More says, well, grant them removed, and grant that this your noise hath chipped down all the majesty of England. Imagine that you see the wretched strangers, their babies at their backs, with their poor luggage plodding to the ports and coasts for transportation, and that you sit as kings in your desires, authority quite silenced by your brawl, and you in rough of your opinions clothed. What had you got? I'll tell you, you had taught how insolence and strong hand should prevail, how order should be quelled, and by this pattern not one of you should live an aged man. For other ruffians, as their fancies wrought, with self-same hand, self-reason and self-right, would shark on you. And men like ravenous fishes feed on one another. Oh, desperate as you are, wash your foul minds with tears, and those same hands that you like rebels lift against the peace, lift up for peace, and your unreverent knees make them your feet to kneel to be forgiven. You'll put down strangers, kill them, cut their throats, and lead the majesty of law in Lyme to snip him like a hound. Say now the king as he is clement. If the offender mourn should so much come too short of your great trespasses, but to banish you, whither would you go? What country by the nature of your error should give you harbour? Go you to France or Flanders, to any German province, Spain or Portugal, nay, anywhere that not adheres to England? Why, you must needs be strangers. Would you be pleased to find a nation of such barbarous temper that breaking out in hideous violence would not afford you an abode on earth? Whet their detested knives against your throats, spurn you like dogs, and like as if the God owned not, nor made not you, nor that the elements were not all appropriate to your comfort, but chartered unto them? What would you think to be thus used? This is the stranger's case, and this your momtonish inhumanity.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Stephen Buehler, Aaron Douglas Professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches courses on Shakespeare and other writers of the English Renaissance. He is the author of Shakespeare in the Cinema, Ocular Proof, and co-founder and education director of the Flatwater Shakespeare Company, based in Lincoln. Dr. Buehler spoke on the topic Shakespeare's First Folio and the First Folio's Shakespeare. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 19, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.